Greetings, and welcome to Bear Soup with Ron Serratia. We have an excellent program this week, so saddle down and listen up, bears. First up, another reading from the book Fairies, Bears, and Leathermen by Peter Hannon, the concluding section of A Brief History of Bears. A fresh interview with Joe Malucci, the silver-tongued daddy of Bear Radio, on the Bear Radio Network's 6th anniversary. An article in this week's paper about endangered four-legged polar bears, and a fundraising idea for bear clubs everywhere. Shoutouts, announcements, and the usual bear puns and furry audio falderall. We're locked and loaded, so stand back. You're just in time for Bear Soup. This is your host, Mr. Bear of the Year 2008, according to the independent poll taken by our friends at thecompletebear.com. Casting my pod to you through the mysterious tubes of the internets, actually from New London, Connecticut. You're listening to episode number 56 of the Bear Soup podcast, streaming online at bearradio.net Mondays and Wednesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific times. Presumably, you can tell without seeing me that I am recording this stark naked in a bubbling hot tub. Bubbles and some rubber duckies for Bear Soup are provided by our friends at Bare Bones Books. Check them out at bearbonesbooks.com.
Wake up, little bear buddy! Awake!
First up, we have a reading from the Queer Men's Studies book, Fairies, Bears, and Leathermen by Peter Hannon, the first part of the section, A Brief History of Bears. Here's another selection from Peter Hannon's book, Fairies, Bears, and Leathermen, which references my book, Bears on Bears, a great number of times. Here's a selection from Chapter 4, A Brief History of Bears. In addition to its appeal as a hedge against effeminacy and its eroticization of the heavier body, the bear phenomenon features at least, while the Lone Star provided a physical space to nurture bear culture, it is Bear Magazine that is frequently credited with shaping bear consciousness, particularly with respect to the idealization and eroticization of the bear body. Wright notes that the, quote, promulgation of idealizing bears in the gay mass media, for better or worse, is the single most powerful force in the current construction of bears. The magazine featured short articles, fiction, and perhaps most important, lots of photographs of naked bears. Quote, Bears started life in 1987 as a pocket format desktop publication, with a run of only a few hundred copies. It soon grew to quarto size and achieved a circulation of many thousands, unquote, from Lucy Smith. Furthermore, the photography represented a fully deliberate attempt to tease out and foster an erotic interest in larger, hairier men. It was these photographs, inevitably, even more than the text, which defined the new image. The photographer's concern has been to give what he sees as an extended dimension, a certain aura which explains the attraction of the cult, and tells us why these men have been selected as desirable. Publisher Richard Bulger, along with photographer Chris Nelson, emphasized the natural appeal of these men from the beginning, as distinguished from the professional models used by other gay men magazines. Quote, Most of the men seen here had never done a photo session before. However, this construction of the natural bear was somewhat circular in that some of the men photographed were already known to the photographer. Others came into contact with him by different routes, for example, because they were readers of Bear magazine. In any event, the photographs made a strong visual statement that clearly appealed to many gay men in the Bay Area, and this appeal was quickly amplified through Bear magazine and expanded across the country through the magazine's rapidly expanding circulation. But it is also clear that aside from combating body fascism in the gay community, Beer Magazine was launched first and foremost as a money-making enterprise. Gay fiction writer and contributor to Beer Magazine, Jack Fritcher, takes an accommodating view, quoting from Jack Fritcher in Bears on Bears. Richard Bulger was trying to find a niche and fill it, get laid and make some money. So Richard, finding a slice of the pie, chose Bears. He could just as easily have chosen Husky Man, as someone did with Husky Magazine. Richard made it appeal to a wider audience, an underserved demographic niche, so that he could sell magazines. Nothing wrong with that. Bear Magazine is a marketing phenom appropriate to the sunny capitalism of gay lib. Bear and American Bear magazines have become a wonderful business that makes a lot of people happy. And that's a wonderful thing, because most gay magazines don't make people happy. For others, the rapacious commodification of bear culture takes on a more sinister tone. Ron Serratia, a bear writer and editor of a recent book on bears, laments, "Now, within the context of the bear community, this means something like, you have value as a person as long as I want something from you. In other words, buy my stuff, give me sex, validate me, and if I like you, I'll say nice things about you too." So there is that multidimensional consumer dynamic that people tend to be very blind to. But while commercial enterprises enthusiastically exploited the emerging niche markets in bear and bear phrenalia, quoting Marx Reidinger, and undoubtedly shaped many of its cultural features, it did not create the community out of whole cloth. The magazines put in what people will buy, so you can't blame the magazine publishers for promoting their idealized bears. After all, that is what people are willing to spend money on. In actuality, Bear Magazine emerged from a bearness that had already existed for at least 15 years before the magazine. How then do we explain this sudden explosion of interest in all things ursine? What existing cultural strands had these entrepreneurs managed to bring together? Like the radical fairy community, the bear movement can be seen in part as a response to the hyper-masculine clone phenomenon of the 1970s. However, in this case, the reaction is significantly more complicated. Bear was a reaction not against the clone's masculinity per se, but against hyper-masculinity and the particular way that the clone deployed the body to signal masculinity: hard, lean, muscled, toned, and smooth. If this is true, it would seem to indicate that bears were interested not so much in revising conventional masculinity, but in resignifying it. Wright concedes as much when he acknowledges that, quote, "bears are fully engaged with hegemonic masculinity, seeking an alternative answer, both accepting some of the trappings while rejecting others." In an intriguing argument, Serratia acknowledges the influence of two other communities that assisted bears in their attempts to resignify the masculine body. He first credits the radical fairies, identifying them as the foremost cultural influence on the bears, and crediting them with creating a contemporary iconography of the hairy natural man. Serratia sees an important connection between the photography in the 1970s edition of RFD and that which appeared later in Bear Magazine. Unposed photos of nude and semi-clad bearded hairy men, a unique medium in which the alternative male body could be romanticized and adored. Serratia even speculates that fairies may have trumped bears in their claims to the natural. One may speculate that, because of the fairies' existence prior to the bears, and based on the cultural evolutionary concept that the natural precedes the artificial, that the bear culture took the ideal of the natural man from the fairies, applied an urban spin to it, and produced a cult that espouses a so-called natural man ideal, while in actuality embodies its opposite. Serratia makes another surprising statement when he acknowledges radical lesbianism as a source of encouragement for bears. He clearly admires lesbians' efforts to reclaim their own bodies from the dominant straight white patriarchy and redefine their own sense of self from the inside out. Among these were radical Rubenesque lesbians who, like bears, were disparaged and fed up with the stereotypes and offensive role-playing presented for common consumption by the traditional heterosexist mainstream. Both of these strands signal an embodied response, one that was elaborated even further through the influence of a third community. For decades prior to the bears' arrival on the scene, the informal national network of chubbies and chasers existed. In the mid-1970s, these contacts were extensive enough so that an informal list could be drawn up and circulated throughout the United States. In 1976, this list was used to develop the Girth and Mirth organization. The original clarion call, appearing in the Berkeley Barb, was entitled Chubbies and Chasers Unite, quoting from Reed Will Gorin in Bears on Bears. And clarion it was. It was like, telephone, tell a friend, tell any chubby chaser and chubby that you know. This was a Saturday or Sunday morning, and people were still home in their robes and slippers, drinking coffee and reading the morning paper when they got the call. It was like electricity went through everyone, thinking, finally, it's happened. Because of the pre-existing network, news of the organization spread like wildfire, and soon Girth and Mirth chapters were established across the country. Reed Will Gorin, one of the founding members of the original Girth and Mirth group in the Bay Area, captures some of the excitement the group generated and the deep meaning it held for many men as a means of raising their status in the greater gay community. Will Gorin describes the group's participation in the first Gay Day Parade in San Francisco and his acute apprehension about how the new group would be received. I did not know what to expect, but when we pulled into the mainstream of the parade onto Market Street, it seemed like, for that moment in my life, the whole world was gay, and we were an incredibly significant part of it all. We had no idea how it was going to change all of our lives as big men and eventually as bears. It was truly amazing how well we were accepted and encouraged to be there at that moment. We were in tears, and we were smiling, we were laughing, crying all through the whole parade. It was a very moving experience, and still feels so, even to talk about it at this moment. Shortly after the Bears became a recognizable subculture within the gay community, tension developed between the two groups. Will Gorin records his continuing attraction to and misgivings about the bear community. Quote, "When the group started, if you sat a big man up next to a bear, you'd see a difference in size and age and mindset. Now, of course, it's changed a lot over the years. Still, in the early days, they were very typecast. I found it kind of difficult to cross over into that group, to be honest with you. Coming from my own personal life experience and being very well accepted socially and sexually as a big man, then going into bear groups was definitely quite a different experience for me. I felt and still do feel sometimes that age and size are definitely a discriminatory factor with bears. It's lessening, though. Those attitudes in general have improved greatly." In the early years, some bears resented the incursion of the Girth and Mirth crowd into the bear community, fearing that fleshiness could be too easily read as feminine, that the softness of the Girth and Mirth body was exactly the kind of representation they were trying to avoid. Nevertheless, a great deal of overlap occurred between the two communities. Interestingly, in many cities, Girth and Mirth chapters went into decline just as bear organizations were cropping up. This shift in membership had a profound effect on bear culture and self-image. Quoting again, "At some point in the early San Francisco bear years, around 1990, when the first Girth and Mirth groups appeared to infiltrate the Lone Star Saloon crowd and to intermingle with the bear hug sex groups, there was a noticeable shift in the way that the local community defined bears and in the way bears defined themselves. It was only later that the basic defining characteristic of a bear as having abundant facial hair or body hair changed to an equal, if not greater, emphasis on body weight. The fact that such an incursion was accomplished, despite formidable resistance, speaks to another formative influence on bear culture and the bear body, AIDS. Kelly and Kane, who describe themselves irreverently as a couple of fat dykes, observe that many relate to the popularity of bears to AIDS and the fear of the emaciated bodies as signifying illness. In his introduction to The Bear Cult, Lucy Smith makes the connection explicit. In Africa, India, and the Pacific Islands, a certain amount of extra weight has traditionally been regarded as a sign of power and potency. With the advent of AIDS, similar attitudes may yet take root in the developed countries. In Africa itself, the colloquial name for the disease is slim. All of these elements, then, contributed to the enormous popularity and growth of bear culture nationwide during the late 1980s and early 1990s, and its expansion internationally in the years thereafter. Detailed published accounts chronicle the formation of local bear organizations in Colorado, Minnesota, the East Coast, Iowa, Houston, Rochester, New York. Accounts of bear culture abroad can be found in Australia, New Zealand, Europe, France, and even Turkey. I haven't noted all of the citations here, but you can find them all in Chapter 4, A Brief History of Bears, in Peter Henin's book, Fairies, Bears, and Leathermen. And now we have an interview with the silver-tongued daddy of Bear Radio, Joe Malucci.
Hello.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Doing good. How are you doing, Ron?
I'm fine, thanks. I'd like to thank you for coming on Bear Soup. And one second here. We have a moment of appreciation for your sixth anniversary. There we go. Yes, it's the old handy fake audience. So
thank you very much.
You're welcome. What were you thinking of 6 years ago when you decided to start an online radio station, Joe?
Well, actually, at the time, I was a member of the Buffalo Bears, and I was their webmaster. And I was always trying to push the envelope as far as how their website was developing. And we had launched about a month prior a thing that we called Woof TV that a friend of mine, Gary Cox, had put together and I helped promote. And I had went out with my partner Luke and attended a coffee house concert in Buffalo with Martin Swinger. And I was sitting there listening to Martin play, and he had talked about during one of his breaks how he plays music that not that many bears have been introduced to. It's not the thumpa thumpa music that the gay community is normally associated with. And I sat there, and by the end of his concert, I thought, bears, radio, I know what my next project is going to be. That's what sparked it, really.
Before there was Bear Radio, there wasn't a place where you could listen to bear-themed music, or really that many places where you could listen to, as you have dubbed the station, eclectic gay radio.
There weren't that many out there, and I still don't think there's that many stations out there that are available.
Does Sirius Satellite Radio have a gay music channel?
They do.
I think it's talk primarily, but they do have some music shows, too.
They have some. I know at one point, some of their people were tuning into Bear Radio to see what I was playing, so they would pick up on folks like Kendall and Elijah Black and Freddie Freeman and those people.
Right. What is it like to have worked with and had so much contact with so many talented musicians? I mean, the playlist on Brave Radio is really gotten to be stupendous.
It's a great networking tool for a lot of people. When Bear Radio started, Freddie Freeman and I really just started working together, and that collaboration, it just got the ball rolling. It brought in people. It's just a pure case of networking.
Yeah.
I would find an artist, he would listen to Bear Radio, and then, he would pick up on that person and invite him to Bearpalooza. My association with the Buffalo Bears and Kendall being from Buffalo, I would tell him about Bear Radio, and at the time, Kendall really had no interest in doing anything bear-related. So then he started getting into the whole bear thing and starting a show that he would perform to bears, and look where he is now.
He's virtually on the centerfold of Bear Magazine, for gosh sakes.
And touring around, doing the Bearpalooza thing, the Bears on the Round thing, doing great
in
that venue. Then I got into the whole thing with Greg Hudson, with Woody Bear Music, they were performing, then they stopped, and Bear Radio sort of like sparked their interest in performing again. You know, got their creative juices flowing again, and they're up and running. And that, for me, is very rewarding.
Among your many accomplishments, I think that the kind of community that you've created on Bear Radio is really something to be proud of.
Thank you.
You're welcome. How many Bear Radio artists are there? And how many new songs come on to the programming, say, every month?
I don't know what the total is. Sorry. New artists, that varies.
Well, there's like, what, there's a couple thousand, you think, of songs?
I wish I had my computer up so that I could, you know, quickly look.
Okay.
Submissions come sporadically, almost seasonal. This week I got maybe like 4 new CDs in. 3 of them made it. One of them didn't.
Oh, really? So not everyone who submits stuff gets it on air, huh?
Not all of them, no. Sometimes it's the subject matter might not work for Bear Radio. They might be just too far out of it, content-wise.
Do you ever get submissions that are just really bad musicianship?
Yeah. I take a listen to things, and if it's a rough production, but the content is good, and musicianship is good, it'll go on. But, you know, if it's out of tune, it's out of tune. And there's nothing you can do about that. And even if the guy's cute, I'm sorry.
I know. It's hard to turn down cute contributors.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I have to look at it from, you know, the listener's point of view.
Right.
If you're going to, you know, put something on the air and ultimately the listener's going to then turn you off, then that's really not going to, you know, that's not going to help both, you know, everyone else that you're trying to promote.
It's not a visual medium. I wanted to ask if you had any upcoming plans or projects for Bear Radio, if you had any other thoughts about your future goals for it.
Right now, we're just going the same route that we have been for, like, the last 6 months. We're always evaluating the sound of the station and looking at other possibilities. We always welcome listener feedback.
And donations.
Yeah.
You don't have to say it, but I will, okay? It's not self-supporting otherwise through advertising. And listeners should know that.
Well, yeah. The main source of revenue that supports the station is my side web design business. But as far as, you know, future plans for Bear Radio, again, we listen to the, you know, what the listeners say, you know, and feedback, and, you know, proceed from there. You know, so if anybody has any concerns or would like to see, you know, other things happen, by all means, drop us a line.
Super. Well, Joe, thank you so much for this long overdue interview. Of course, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and especially so now on your 6th anniversary with Bear Radio.
Well, thank you for calling.
Well, take good care, and we'll be in touch soon.
You do the same, Ron.
Okay. This has been an interview with Joe Malucci, proprietor of BearRadio.net. Here's another article about the polar bear, dated Saturday, October 17th, 2009, from the Associated Press. U.S. seeks tougher protections for polar bear. Commercial trade banned. Trophy hunting regulated with proposal, by Dina Capiello. With global warming shrinking Arctic sea ice that polar bears depend on for survival, the United States is seeking to remove another major threat, international trade in the bear's fur and other parts. In a proposal filed this week, the Interior Department asked other countries to support a ban on the commercial trade of polar bears and to strictly regulate trophy hunting. The request, if approved, would give the bear the most stringent protection afforded under an international convention to protect endangered species.
It would also upgrade protections for the bear internationally for the first time since 1975, when the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, C-I-T-E-S, required export permits for the polar bear. Since then, mounting scientific evidence has shown that Arctic sea ice is melting and suggests that global warming may cause the disappearance of summer sea ice in 30 years. In May 2008, the U.S. classified the polar bear as a threatened species, the first with its survival at risk due to global warming. The determination made all but subsistence hunting illegal. The U.S. pitch argues that the loss of sea ice could make the toll of trade and hunting on the bear worse. Quote, "The underlying melting of the Arctic ice is an issue no single country can address," said Tom Strickland, the Interior Department Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. "This is part of a comprehensive approach to try to provide additional protection for this important, iconic species." Data available on polar bear trade shows that since the early 1990s, the market for polar bear carcasses and parts has increased. From 1992 to 2006, approximately 31,294 live polar bears, carcasses, or parts were exported to 73 different countries, according to data collected by the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Skins are the most popular export item, and Canada is the largest commercial exporter. Environmentalists said Friday that they hope the proposal, which will be voted on by 175 nations in March at a CITES meeting in Doha, Qatar, will end the Canadian hunt by requiring trophy hunters to also get an import permit. Quote, "Picking off animals in the most important population one by one is dangerous. It's time to end the hunt and trade there," said Andrew Wetzler, Director for Wildlife Conservation at the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. So you can contact the Natural Resources Defense Council, whom we've talked about on this show before, at nrdc.org. In Kevin Bowe's film, A Bear's Story, there's a Bears for Bears benefit beer bust for the preservation of four-legged bears. And I have this idea that I'd like to share with you, and I hope you can share with other folks, particularly if you are a member of a bear club anywhere around the nation or around the world. Perhaps some of the fundraising efforts that bear clubs do could actually be directed towards organizations like the National Resources Defense Council and the World Wildlife Fund that are really working hard to ensure the preservation of four-legged bears. So tell me what you think about it. Write to me at bearsoup@gmail.com. And thanks. You've been listening to Bear Soup with Ron Serratia. Check out the Bear Soup link on my homepage, www.ronserratia.com, spelled RONSURESHA.com. Bear Soup is news, opinions, stories, and interviews for the bear community. Bubbles for the Bear Soup Hot Tub are powered by our sponsor, Bare Bones Books. Please check out their fine titles by bear authors at barebonesbooks.com. Please feel free to contact me at bearsoup@gmail.com. Shoutouts! Music by The Mermen, Jeff Mann, Steve Berman, Dan Jaffe, Scott and Mike. That's it for Bear Soup number 56. Thanks for listening.